Chapter 10, New Colgate. The 60s and all that that tumultuous decade conjures hit Colgate with full force in the wee hours of Sunday morning, April 7th, 1968, just 3 days after the assassination of Martin Luther King, Jr. Two black students, Robert Boney, class of 69, and Naceo Giles, class of 70, were walking past the Sigma Nu fraternity house when a member of the fraternity shouted racial epithets from the roof. Suddenly, three gunshots rang out in the chilly springtime air, reportedly, later, from a track starter's pistol. Boney took cover behind a tree while Giles rounded up most of the members of the Association of Black Collegians, the ABC. Around 4 a.m., the ABC members rushed into the house and confronted the Sigma Nu brothers, demanding to know who had fired the shots and that they hand over the weapons. They threatened to burn down the house if the fraternity brothers did not comply. Guy Martin, class of 57, the dean of admissions, arrived on the scene quickly, and President Vincent Barnett was soon summoned to handle negotiations. The white student who had allegedly fired the shots, was taken into custody, but released by the village justice of the peace, further inflaming the situation. The tense confrontation finally came to an end in mid-morning when President Barnett, after phone calls to Chairman of the Board Wellington Powell, agreed to suspend the fraternity's charter and to immediately close the house. On Monday evening, the faculty met and passed a resolution recommending that the board dissolve Sigma Nu. They also censured a second fraternity, Phi Delta Theta, which had never had a black or Jewish member and whose blackball system had enabled a single fraternity brother to prevent a Jewish student from joining. Earlier in the year, that overtly discriminatory act had led the Student Senate to banish Phi Delta from the Senate and to urge the Board of Trustees to revoke its charter. Registering its distress with the fraternity's discriminatory practices, the faculty also called for a policy of open housing in every university-authorized residence. Meanwhile, the ABC broadened its demands. Headed by its charismatic leader, Bill Robinson, class of 69, it called for the university to establish a cooperative residential center for black students, to introduce a required course in black history, and to hire more black faculty members and administrators. It also appealed for support from fellow students, asking for formal ABC representation on student senate committees. The next afternoon, the ABC focused on the festering fraternity crisis and presented President Barnett with an ultimatum to revoke Phi Delta Theta's charter immediately and permanently and to close the house. They warned that failure to meet their demands within 24 hours would lead to a direct confrontation with the administration by the black people of this community. Shortly before leaving for New York City for the spring meeting of the Board of Trustees, Barnett told the ABC leaders that the demands could not be met within so short a time, and he alerted his staff to the likely takeover of the administration building. With tensions mounting as a Wednesday 2 p.m. deadline approached, Phi Delta attempted to defuse the situation, issuing a statement saying that it had freed itself from constitutional restrictions in membership selection based on race, color, creed, or national origin, and henceforth there would be no procedures in this chapter of Phi Delta Theta which would sustain de facto discrimination. Their concession was not enough to sway the protesters. Declaring that Colgate's future as a liberal arts institution depends on action now against campus racism, the ABC posted a mimeographed broadside around campus calling for a mass demonstration outside the student union at 1 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon. More than 400 students showed up. Rallying the crowd, one speaker led a call and response. "Are all of us in this together?" "Yes," the crowd responded. "Are promises enough?" "No." "Are you concerned?" "Yes." "This country has procrastinated long enough." Then Robinson addressed the demonstration. "Time's now for action. and all you, all who say you're concerned for this university and this society, had better act, and act right now. The crowd began marching toward the administration building, entering it at 2:15. Administrators and secretarial staff packed up and departed. Guy Martin announced that he was closing his office in sympathy with the protest. Recalling the events 50 years later, Greg Threet, class of 69, a member of the ABC, said that as the demonstration began, black students thought they might be the only ones to protest. They were astounded when so many other students marched with them from Whitnall Field and through the doors of the administration building. When the takeover began, President Barnett was in New York with the Board of Trustees, and the ABC leadership opened its negotiations with Dean of Students William Griffith. Barnett hastened back to campus and joined the discussions on Thursday morning. After 18 hours of negotiations and extensive telephone consultations with the trustees, Barnett announced at 2:30 a.m. on Friday that Phi Delta's charter would be revoked immediately, explaining that its practices were in conflict with university policy. But Barnett sent mixed signals. He noted that the fraternity's national constitution could not be revised to eliminate the blackball system for at least 2 more years, and he did not order the fraternity brothers to vacate the premises. The status of their house remained unresolved. Barnett, acting with the concurrence of Board Chairman Powell, proposed that a trustee panel be created to explore issues with the American Civil Liberties Union and New York State's Commission on Human Rights. This move is motivated, he said, by the conviction that there are questions of human rights involved on both sides of the remaining issues. The ABC's leadership rejected the proposal, holding out for the immediate closing of the house. The occupation continued, with students and faculty crowding the offices and hallways of the administration building. The strong support from outside astonished the protesters. The university food service sent food, supportive faculty wives delivered hot meals, 2 village restaurants donated food. Some students brought in bunk beds. WRCU, the campus radio station, broadcast live from the scene. At one point, when protesters answered a knock on the door, a member of the college custodial staff appeared with a delivery of toilet paper and, of course, was welcomed inside. While negotiations dragged on, students were entertained by a reading from visiting poet James Tate. They sang "We Shall Overcome" to a sitar accompaniment and listened to a harpsichord recital on an instrument that they had delicately carried into the building. Inside, some fraternity members vowed to quit their fraternities to protest selective procedures in their houses. Outside, other fraternity members attempted in vain to rally support for a counter-demonstration. As the sit-in continued, Barnett seemed to find that something profound was taking place. Noting that the ABC was taking the lead, he described it as a very unusual situation, a real experience, in a sense a religious experience, and felt the commitment of the white protesters in a Negro cause and leadership seemed to have, for many participants, the emotional intensity of worship. A memorable worship service was, in fact, held during the takeover. Students and faculty of all faiths were invited to a Passover Seder in Guy Martin's office. The story of the Hebrew flight from Egypt and their escape from bondage seemed especially poignant and fitting. Inside the administration building, the emotions of the protesters were intense, but the issues that lingered over the weekend were cast in legalistic terms. What precisely did it mean to revoke the fraternity's charter, especially if the Phi Delta brothers were permitted to remain in the house? Several clarifications followed. Finally, late in the afternoon, on Easter Sunday, Barnett submitted his third statement of clarification. Those living in the house would no longer be permitted to function as an organized living unit. They could have no governance structure, no representation in the Student Senate, no intramural teams, and no house parties. At 6:30 p.m., his explanation was accepted, and 500 students, their number had grown over the weekend with some estimates as high as 650, and 36 faculty members marched out. The protest had lasted 101 hours. The most unexpected consequence of the sit-in was the resignation a month later of President Barnett, who announced in a brief letter to the chairman of the board in late May that he had decided to leave in the best interests of the university and his own personal and professional best interests. While the events of the spring clearly precipitated his decision, tensions with board members were also rumored to have sped his departure. Few on campus knew that he had begun quietly the previous autumn to discuss a return to Williams College. Many Colgate faculty and students lamented the loss, some regretting that more had not been done to ease the burdens that weighed on him that spring, others feeling that the university would miss his moderation and sound judgment, and still others fearing a setback to the academic vitality he had brought to campus. A letter from John Morris, the newly appointed dean of faculty, was characteristic. "Colgate owes a tremendous debt to you, and it has repaid you in very bad coin these last few months." Even student participants in the administration building takeover chimed in to applaud Barnett, as did John Romano, class of 70, who sent him a letter that summer. "In the spring crisis and the ensuing confusion, the roles of many people were badly obscured. In the curious geometry of polarization, we were all caught in the middle. From where I stood," wrote Romano, "you were never the enemy. Moreover, Colgate was, is, not Columbia, as much because you are not Grayson Kirk and we are not the SDS. Romano was referring to the violent confrontation in late April and early May when Columbia President Kirk filed trespassing charges and called in the police to clear student-occupied buildings on his campus. By contrast, Barnett had resisted the council of board members who sought more aggressive measures to oust the Colgate students. Among others in the administration, Dean Griffith was also thought by many to have become a silent supporter of the students' cause. Colgate's protest had ended peacefully, even joyfully. Some participants now vaguely recall that the alma mater was sung when it ended, and protesters had taken care to leave the building in pristine shape as they departed. Despite the peaceful ending, the university community remained deeply divided, and for many faculty members, the healing would take years. Reviewing the events 4 months after tendering his resignation, Barnett characterized the board and alumni reaction as falling into two camps. Some felt the actions to end the blackball system and discrimination were long overdue. Others maintained that those who had taken over the building deserved severe punishment. The latter were more vocal, Barnett observed, and they disagreed strongly with my method of handling the case. Nevertheless, as he reflected on his relatively brief tenure as president, the dramatic events of spring 1968 paled next to his proudest accomplishments: the creation of 7 faculty-endowed chairs, reform of the academic calendar, which had opened the way for both the Jan Plan and more expansive opportunities for independent study, and the dedication of the Dana Arts Center. Looking ahead, he seemed at peace with the role students had begun to play and would continue to play in shaping the future of the university. Shortly before his departure, however, the university put in place injunctive procedures to handle campus protests, while letting student leaders know that police might be called in to deal with future campus disruptions. Those stricter university policies came into play a year later, at the end of another tense spring. In late March 1969, a group of young men from the village attacked 2 black students. Dismayed with the university's handling of the off-campus assault, the ABC was also increasingly dissatisfied in the face of delays in establishing what it described as a black ethnic cultural center. During the takeover of the administration building the previous year, the university had agreed to turn over to the proper authorities the ABC's request for what they discreetly called now a special student center. The faculty lent its support to the concept of such a center in December 1968. When discussions about a site and funding languished, the ABC reiterated its demand in April 1969 and issued a broadside again, complaining that despite promises, nothing has been done. We now demand a cultural center. President pro tem Franklin Wallen responded, promising that a center would be open no later than the beginning of the 1969-70 academic year, and he offered them Taylor House, an aging two-story frame house on Broad Street near the entrance to Oak Drive. After he and others reviewed the plans with ABC President Naceo Giles, everyone seemed to realize that the work to renovate the house, which had been built for Stephen Taylor in 1840 and used variously as the YMCA headquarters and the faculty club, could not be completed by the fall. Moreover, Giles and his fellow ABC members deemed Taylor House too small. They wanted both a cultural center and housing for at least 10 students. The ABC was frustrated about the lack of progress, and at 4 a.m. on April 25th, 30 to 40 ABC members marched into Merrill House, where the faculty club operated on the first floor, and rooms for campus visitors occupied the upper floor. They asked the resident caretakers and several overnight visitors to leave, politely, according to the housekeeper, Nora Clark. Dean Griffith promptly told the students that they were in violation of university policy and might be subject to suspension or expulsion if they did not vacate the house by 11 a.m. Negotiations began, and Wallen sought a compromise by offering the Alton Lounge and third floor space in the student union as the venue for a black cultural center. ABC countered with another proposal conceived by the father of one of its members, construction of an entirely new center which would include housing for 40 students. At a total cost of $200,000, the ABC pledged to raise half. Because the university would pay the other half, Wallen agreed to present the plan to the trustees. And some 1,300 students gathered in the chapel to voice support for the ABC and to offer their help in raising funds for the project. Individual dormitories and fraternities also promised to help with fundraising. The crisis began to ease when Franklin Williams, a prominent black scholar at Columbia University and former ambassador to Ghana, stepped in as a mediator. He advised the students to leave Merrill House if the university sought an injunction. Late Sunday afternoon, the executive committee of the Board of Trustees took steps to do exactly that, ordering Wallen to begin legal procedures to clear Merrill House. The trustees said they would not consider the ABC proposal as long as the house was occupied. With an injunction threatened, the ABC members left shortly after 1 a.m. on Monday, bringing their 70-hour occupation to an end. The Maroon editors gave full credit to the ABC for avoiding a confrontation, writing that the university was saved, undeservedly saved, by the forbearance and goodwill of its black students. Wallen expressed his relief at the outcome, concluding it was based on the faith in our ability to trust one another. That sense of trust, as well as student forbearance during the crisis, were factors leading to the creation of a new university governance structure in 1970. It gave students a greater voice in university decision-making and seemed, for a time, to have tempered student protests. Some of the ABC's demands were met during the next academic year. A program in Afro-American Studies started modestly in 1969-70, with a university studies course on the black experience. As new faculty were hired and new courses taught, an African-American studies major was approved in 1974. Curricular change proceeds fitfully. Manning Marable, a distinguished historian and prominent social critic, was hired in 1983 to direct the program and brought with him the hope that a program conceived in the protest movements of the 1960s could overcome perceptions that it had entered the curriculum primarily to appease minority students. Marable remained for only 3 years, and after several years of interim leadership and uncertainty, Roy Bryce LaPorte was appointed to direct the program in 1989. He led both the Africana and Latin American programs, two programs that have remained together since the 1980s in a marriage of convenience. Like Marable, Bryce LaPorte understood how difficult it was to build a robust interdisciplinary program in a relatively small college when hiring decisions and teaching obligations remain vested in academic departments. Bryce LaPorte sought to build a sound and broadly appealing program, believing that the image of these programs as non-traditional or advocacy programs needs to be confronted and dispelled. The program has continued to look broadly at the history and cultures of African Americans as well as peoples of Africa, the Caribbean, and Latin America. The ABC's principal goal in seizing Merrill House in 1969 was to speed the establishment of a cultural center and a new residence for minority students. In the end, these two demands were decades in the making, and their evolution has tracked the growing diversity of Colgate's student body and alumni population. In 1970, a site used by the Building and Grounds Department for a maintenance building was handed over to the ABC and renovated. In 1982, with the ABC still lacking a residential center, two floors in East Hall were designated as the Harlem Renaissance Center, where students of any race with an interest in black culture could live together. The hope was to draw both black and white students into a living situation that would improve the quality of interaction between blacks and whites while focusing on the black experience. The Harlem Renaissance Center has moved to other locations over the years, and in 2017 joined forces with a new residential commons in Crawshaw House. Fittingly, the commons is named for an early civil rights leader, Gordon Blaine Hancock, a 1920 alumnus of the seminary and recipient of an honorary degree in 1969. A longtime professor of sociology at Virginia Union University, Hancock was a prolific writer on racial issues and a co-founder of the Southern Regional Council. Not until the mid-1980s were plans for the construction of a new, more adequate cultural center set in motion. At the dedication of the building in April 1989, a plaque was unveiled paying tribute to those brothers whose vision, determination, and sacrifice to the ideals of cultural and ethnic diversity provided the foundation for the cultural center's reality. Its mission widened as the student body grew more diverse and renamed the Alana Center in 1996. The acronym reflected the center's embrace of students whose heritage was African, Latino, Asian, and Native Americans. Some 50 years after the takeover of the administration building in Merrill House, nearly one quarter of the student body self-identifies as black, Hispanic Latino, Asian, Native American, or mixed background. An additional 10% hailed from outside the United States. As the hub of multicultural activities on campus, the Alana Center hosts activities organized by nearly two dozen student groups. They reflect the growing racial and ethnic diversity of the campus, a decades-long process set in motion by the activism of bold students in the late 1960s. Cultural happenings. The political ferment of the 60s had its counterpart in an outpouring of artistic creativity. With the opening of the Dana Art Center, still 2 years away, a muddy construction site had triggered the weekend festival of the creative arts in 1964. Dana's dedication in May 1966 inspired much more. Students hatched an ambitious plan for artistic residencies and an inspiring cultural festival. George Brown, class of 68, and Barnett Kelman, class of 69, toiled for a year and a half on their project, hoping initially to bring several prominent figures in the arts to campus for a 2-week residency. As they raised funds, negotiated with agents and performers, conceived of adapting several other campus venues for multimedia performances, and asked more profound questions about how the arts might be celebrated, their plans evolved into a full-blown multidisciplinary festival, which they called the Fortnight of the Active Arts. In March 1968, less than a month before the administration building takeover, the campus was transformed into a festival, a kind of 60s happening, which, in the language of the era, was the organizers' preferred descriptive term for what they had planned. Their aims were to break down walls between artist and audience, reveal the creative possibilities of mixed artistic media, and inspire new creative possibilities on a campus where artistic activities had finally found a physical locus in the Dana Arts Center. They had hoped to invite Marshall McLuhan, the author of The Medium is the Message, a popular analysis of mass media, but settled for polymath Buckminster Fuller, whose keynote pen to technology and technological fallout set the tone. But it was the workshops, open rehearsals, and performances, and not the lectures, that eventually defined the spirit of the fortnight. Richard Martin and Morton Subotnick joined forces in a light and music composition and transformed the Art Center into games rooms that challenged clusters of students to move through the building while interacting with audiovisual technologies. Stan Vanderbeek set up multiple screens and brought his avant-garde animations and computer-generated films, along with two dancers, to the Memorial Chapel. Painter Jack Twerkoff and sculptor James Rossati exhibited and discussed their works, and Merce Cunningham and John Cage drew a large audience to a performance on Cotterill Court, which included readings from Cage's Silence, and a revival of their 1966 collaboration, How to Pass, Kick, Fall, and Run. A student critic praised the disciplined freedom of the dancers and seemed to grasp why the festival spoke of the active arts. Describing Cage, as he calmly read and sipped champagne at the edge of the stage, seemingly not engaged with the dancers, the reviewer concluded, "This left a good part of the creation process to the perceiver. It was the viewer's job to attach Cage with the dance troupe if he could or wanted to." Kelman realized one of his dreams by bringing the cutting-edge Open Theater of New York and its director Joseph Chaykin to campus, where they previewed Jean-Claude Van Italy's still-unfinished theater piece, The Serpent, A Ceremony. A student reviewer captured its spirit as movement without dance, sound without voice, theater without acting. The New York Times also covered the rehearsals, workshops, and performances, headlining its article, "The Open Theater Turns Colgate On." When the Open Theater performance ended, an ecstatic audience of 500, President Barnett among them, joined hands to form a serpentine line and throng the stage in a frenzy of togetherness with the cast. The fortnight met its expenses, which totaled $37,000, garnering foundation donations and government support from both the New York State Council on the Arts and the two-year-old National Endowment for the Arts, which had taken a substantial risk in contributing $5,300 from NEA's still small budget to a student-run festival. George Brown, who had negotiated with performers, also made shrewd decisions about student ticketing. A $10 all-inclusive fee with a $5 premium for those who wanted to bring dates. He also knew that adding a rock group to the roster of performers would stimulate sales. Failing to land Jefferson Airplane, they secured The Doors and Jim Morrison, along with a less well-known opening group, the Stone Ponies, and their lead singer, Linda Ronstadt. Before the festival opened, Kelman told the Maroon he wanted more than a weekend splash. He hoped that people would see how the arts fit into their daily lives and would be inspired to creative participation. It worked, and new arts organizations began to flourish, with Kelman founding his own new troupe, the Celebrant Ensemble. His company worked with the Open Theater to create Brother Right, a play that found its way into the core curriculum's P&R course, as did the group's production of the Eumenides. Inspired by the fortnight, campus arts criticism and commentary also took off in a new journal, the Fortnightly Review, which was incorporated as a supplement to the Maroon. The performing arts remained in the spotlight well past the closing of the fortnight, but the literary arts were also a vital part of the campus cultural boom of the 1960s. Like music, extracurricular literary efforts were deeply rooted at Colgate, tracing their beginnings to the Aeonian and Adelphian societies founded in 1840. Society members listened to orations, essays, poems, and stories, subjecting their fellow students' efforts to careful criticism. The writings of the Aeonian Society were preserved in bound volumes called the Aeonian Casket. The Salmagundi, which first appeared in 1884, also published student poems, plays, short stories, and cartoons in a literary miscellany. In the 20th century, dozens more student efforts came and went, some producing merely a single issue and others lasting only a year or two. On occasion, campus newspapers have also published creative supplements. These diverse outlets for creative writing have typically been student-run, highly entrepreneurial, and often ephemeral. The signs of a new student and faculty literary awakening were in the air even before the fortnight. Opportunities to hear and meet visiting writers expanded enormously during the 1960s when English professor Bruce Berlin, who arrived at Colgate in 1954, began to invite writers to campus, among them the Soviet-born Yevgeny Yevtushenko and Andrei Voznesensky. A poet and translator, Berlin introduced American audiences to European poets and won special acclaim for his translations of Hungarian poets. Writers, including the Irish novelist John McGairn and the poet Anne Sexton, began to teach as visiting professors in the late 1960s. The novelist Frederick Bush began his 37-year career at Colgate in 1966, and by 1981, the regular visits of writers evolved into a semester-long living writers course, which brought authors to campus each week to discuss their recent books. Subsequently, guided by English professors Jane Pynchon and Jennifer Bryce, this popular course has continued and now reaches an off-campus audience as an online course available to alumni. Peter Balakian joined the faculty in 1980, collaborating initially with Berlin on the poetry series and then continuing to bring poets to campus after Berlin's retirement in 1987. Balakian has won awards as a memoirist, historian of the Armenian Genocide, and poet, and was recognized with a Pulitzer Prize for poetry in 2016. With authors of stature securing places on the tenured faculty, visiting writers in diverse genres, spending time with aspiring student authors, and a post-MFA fellowship program bringing young writers to campus, creative writing continued to flourish in the English department, and by 1990, writing had found a formal place in the curriculum. Vietnam and the voices of protest. Beneath the surface of college life in the 1960s, the war in Vietnam exerted a constant undertow. The military draft loomed large in the lives of students. It drove decisions about graduate school and careers, and often meant that future prospects had to be deferred until military obligations were satisfied. As others had in previous wars, many Colgate students served with distinction in Vietnam. Some died there. A plaque in the chapel bears the names of 20 students killed in Vietnam with class years spanning 1954 to 1970. Among them is Stephen J. Riggs, class of 65, captain of the hockey team, who is memorialized in the Class of 65 hockey arena. As the Vietnam War ground on from year to year, student opposition mounted. In 1968 and 69, Colgate students used the morning chapel period to read the names of those killed. They joined marches in Washington and participated in the monthly moratorium movement to end the war. There were few moments on campus more dramatic than the night of December 1, 1969, when the Vietnam-era draft lottery was broadcast to the nation. Students gathered to watch in dormitory basements and fraternity houses as 366 opaque blue capsules containing the year's dates were drawn one by one from a large glass jar. The birthday lottery set the order in which men between the ages of 19 and 26 would be drafted. Campus tensions did not diminish, even as those with high lottery numbers, 225 and above, were assured they would not be drafted. In the spring of 1970, 11 students blocked Marine recruiters at the Career Service Center and were brought before the University Judiciary Board. Their student defense counsel, Dennis Reardon, class of 70, argued that military recruitment was not an essential function of a liberal arts college, and thus university functions had not been disrupted. He also contended that no evidence had been presented to show that any student had been denied an interview with the recruiters, and the 11 student defendants were acquitted. Campus divisions persisted. Sometimes it was about an inchoate jumble of disputes over large issues like the war, the draft, and fraternities. Sometimes it was about nothing at all. A group of students attacked a fraternity house and broke windows at Phi Kappa Tau. A sculpture was subsequently torched in front of an upper-class dorm. Fights broke out among students. A fraternity member was attacked. "The campus is literally ready to explode," said the Maroons editors. Tensions grew in April 1970 when Abby Hoffman, an anarchist rabble-rouser, founder of the Yippies, the Youth International Party, and one of the defendants in the trial of the Chicago Seven, arrived to speak in the chapel. An audience of 1,500 crowded in to hear him. As he tried to make his way inside the chapel, 10 students blocked his way. In the pushing and shoving that followed, Hoffman pulled a knife from his pocket, apparently cutting himself but hurting no one else. His speech was not memorable, but the event prompted a discussion about free speech. The students, who sought to block him, thought his mere presence was an incitement to violence. Hoffman had, in fact, advocated violence on other occasions. The Maroons editors questioned the actions of those who tried to prevent him from speaking, saying that they were the ones who had opened up the very possibility of violence. The editors then offered a ringing endorsement of free speech. "To block a person from addressing the student body is to forfeit the concept of an open university dedicated to the enhancement of knowledge and free expression of ideas." At Colgate and across the nation, student protests intensified when President Richard Nixon announced on April 30, 1970, that American ground forces had expanded their operations into Cambodia. After 4 Kent State University demonstrators were killed on May 4th by Ohio National Guardsmen, more than 2,000 campuses erupted. 2 days later, police wounded 4 protesters at the University of Buffalo, and a week and a half after that, 2 students were killed at Jackson State University in Mississippi. 16 states called out National Guard units to quell campus unrest. Many schools canceled classes because of student strikes and walkouts. And at Colgate, classes came to an abrupt end after a packed student assembly in the chapel called for a strike. Students made arrangements with individual faculty members to complete their spring semester's coursework or not. While the anger at Colgate was intense, it took a distinctive turn, diverging in tone and manner from demonstrations breaking out at other colleges. Members of the Colgate Student Strike Committee saw an opportunity to enlist students on other campuses, where opposition to the war had not been as vigorous. Operating from the chapel basement, they worked the phones and reached out to upstate colleges and community colleges. Utica, Lemoyne, Hobart, Hamilton, Kirkland, Wells, Mohawk Valley, Morrisville, and Herkimer. Looking for a protest site off campus, they settled on Griffiths Air Force Base in Rome, New York. Colgate organizers wanted to make sure any demonstration would be lawful and peaceful. And on May 6th, a delegation traveled to Rome and met with the mayor, police chief, and commissioner of public safety. They secured a parade permit, agreed on a line of march, and even arranged for parking at an outdoor amphitheater. Students also met with the commander of the Air Force Base, Colonel Wesley Britting, to explain their plans to gather outside the base's Floyd Avenue gate from 1 to 5 p.m. on May 8th. The students agreed that the protesters would not cross a white line painted on the road 30 yards from the gate, while the base commander said that a small delegation would be allowed to enter through the gate and carry their message to the base leadership. On a warm and sunny spring day, buses pulled into the Kent Amphitheater parking lot, and 75 safety marshals, recruited from the participating colleges, confiscated glass bottles, sticks affixed to protest signs, and anything else that might look like a weapon. Only 500 demonstrators were expected, but newspaper estimates put the crowd at 1,200 to 1,400. When the march began, student marshals stood along a white line marking the limit of their approach to the base. Behind them, and generally out of the way, were 35 Rome policemen. A five-man delegation stepped toward the line and was allowed to cross and enter the base and to meet with Colonel Britting. The conversation was cordial and respectful. Afterward, the civility of the speeches outside the base and the amicability of the protesters led Rome's Commissioner of Public Safety to remark, as the students headed home, "If more peaceful demonstrations are like this, the public may alter its opinion of college students." While some members of the strike committee worked locally, others looked toward Washington, particularly after they realized that Colgate had a unique connection to the Nixon administration. Howard Fineman, class of 70, who had just stepped down as editor-in-chief of the Maroon, proposed that students try to meet with Secretary of State William P. Rogers, class of 34, and a Colgate trustee. Their audacious demand, years later Fineman called it ridiculous, was that because Nixon's decision to invade Cambodia, unauthorized, unilateral, cold-blooded, and lethal to innocent civilians, was incompatible with the values of Colgate as a liberal arts institution, either he must quit as Secretary of State or quit the board. Ethically, morally, he could not continue to do both. Fineman saw a straight line running from the moral sensibilities instilled by PNR to the meeting they sought in Washington, saying simply, "The core was the anchor." A delegation was selected to meet with Rogers, and calls went out to Washington study group members explaining that students would soon be headed from Hamilton to Foggy Bottom and the State Department offices. Mark Nozette, class of 71, was with the study group and alerted several members of the press he had met on Capitol Hill. Hundreds of Colgate students made their way to Washington on May 9th. A large demonstration was planned for the mall, which ultimately drew upwards of 100,000 people. Some of them assembled at a side entrance to the State Department. Presenting themselves at the building's door, seven students asked to meet with Rogers. After a brief wait, they were ushered to his eighth-floor office. It isn't clear whether the meeting had been facilitated in advance, perhaps with an intervention by Professor Huntington Terrell. The Secretary of State greeted the group amicably and pulled a chair from behind his desk, while the students sat in a semicircle around him. He told them about a protest during his student days when Shine State Theater decided to raise movie ticket prices. One of the students then spoke testily about graver events and the seriousness of student outrage about the war. He pointed toward the window and the massive gathering on the mall. Rogers rose to peer out the window. Dennis Reardon then steered the conversation toward constitutional questions and the morality of the war. Rogers made no effort to defend the war. As Fineman recalls, Rogers posed two questions. What if the policy works and it helps end the war quickly? The students had no answer. He then hinted at where he stood. Let's say you're an officer on a ship. The captain issues an order you don't agree with. What do you do? Deflecting their demand about his service on the Colgate board, Rogers spoke about the possibility of resigning at a later date, but not, he said, because of the anti-war protests. Descending to the street, the delegation was surrounded by reporters from all three major networks and various newspapers. The Colgate protest was widely reported by the national media. While everyone was interviewed, Reardon took the lead and continued to speak about the morality of the war. He summarized the tone of the meeting, saying, "There was no communications gap between the Secretary and ourselves. We understood each other very clearly. We completely disagree with each other. It's as simple as that." Assessing the meeting's impact, he said the students had not expected much to come of it, but "we have proven that there is a great deal of student energy and a great deal of concern for many of the problems facing the world today." Other students were asked
whether they had been radicalized by the experience of meeting with Rogers. They replied that they did not plan to join violent groups like the Weathermen. It was only later that former Maroon editor Feynman realized they had all missed the biggest story of all. Rogers had not explicitly defended the Cambodia invasion, thus hinting at his opposition to it. The students were unaware at the time that he had voiced his opposition to the Cambodian incursion in cabinet meetings. The coda to the encounter with the Secretary of State in Washington, perhaps the coda to the decade of the 1960s, came the following year at Colgate's 1971 graduation, where Rogers received an honorary degree and gave the commencement address. Colgate's 11th president, Thomas A. Bartlett, presided over the ceremonies. A Stanford-trained political scientist and Rhodes Scholar, Bartlett was in his second year as president, having arrived in 1969 from the American University in Cairo. Realizing that students were planning to protest, Bartlett negotiated with both the Secretary of State's staff and Thomas O'Brien, the class valedictorian and also a Rhodes Scholar. The negotiations led to assurances that Rogers would be able to speak without disruption, but that the students would be allowed in some fashion to express their disapproval of the war. In the weeks before graduation, nearly 200 seniors had signed a statement saying that they would not accept a combat role in Indochina. Many students wanted to walk out of the graduation ceremony and hold their own counter-graduation. The ceremony went forward as scheduled and without disruption, with United Nations Secretary General U Thant among those receiving honorary degrees. Rogers' speech was a sweeping overview of the foreign policy achievements of the Nixon administration, including the prospects for American withdrawal from the war as the policy of Vietnamization took hold. He was applauded politely. O'Brien then offered what he called his counterstatement, saying he respected the speech and the person of the Secretary of State, but disagreed with his views. He offered his own brief assessment of the impact of the war on the Vietnamese people. Then, by way of explaining the student protest, he spoke about the aims of education. "The whole purpose of America's experiment in mass higher education," he said, "was to produce individuals who could improve the system by constantly questioning old modes of doing things, by a relentless criticism of the outmoded and useless." Alluding to what he and his classmates had learned in the Corps about the unexamined life, he explained, "What many young people across this country are doing is extending that basic notion of Socrates to the life of the whole culture. They were examining their own values and those of their society." O'Brien's graduation address ended prophetically and poetically with words from Allen Ginsberg's Howl and the poet's invocation of the destructive demon Moloch. He then read the names of 175 classmates who had pledged not to serve in combat in Vietnam, and one by one they stood. And when O'Brien finished, he asked audience members seated in the Cottrell Court stands to rise in support. Approximately 2,000 of the 3,000 in attendance then stood. Bartlett immediately offered an apology to Rogers, feeling that O'Brien had violated their agreement by asking the audience to join the protest. "I am deeply troubled. I am profoundly disappointed," he said. "This is a misuse of me. This is a misuse of the occasion and a misuse of Secretary Rogers." Sentiments within the class were divided about the form the protest took. One who stood, when his name was read, criticized Bartlett. "The ceremony was not misused," Neil Dana Gluckin, 71, wrote in The Maroon. "It was given new life as one after another of the seniors committed themselves to what they considered to be a mandate of conscience. Such a demonstration of commitment and responsibility could never have taken place," he believed, "without a strong regard for the meaning of a Colgate education." The years of anti-war protest resonated in the core curriculum and also gave birth to one of the oldest and still thriving interdisciplinary programs. It was conceived in the heyday of Vietnam anti-war activism and longer-term worries about the Cold War arms race. Founded in 1970 by Professor of Geography Theodore Herman and subsequently directed by Nigel Young, Peace Studies, later renamed Peace and World Order Studies and now called Peace and Conflict Studies, was described at its earliest incarnation as an interdisciplinary study of peacemaking and peacekeeping that avowed an active vocational quest for a world community liberated by a just and viable system of peace. Viewing Colgate students in mid-decade, the 1966 Middle States accreditation team had lamented the reluctance of students to seek out roles of responsibility in self-government and noted their apparently minimal engagement in issues of intellectual and ideological controversy. That team could not have foreseen the student political and cultural awakening that hit with such surprising force over the ensuing 4 years. After the administration building takeover, Student Senate President Robert Seberg, class of 69, spoke of the incongruity of a liberal arts college that claimed to develop a sense of civic responsibility in its students, denying them a role in shaping the future course of the college. How can one be a man, he asked in 1968, without the power to make decisions which govern his life? Students began to talk earnestly about a new Colgate, noting not only the flourishing artistic endeavors and a political awakening, but also declining fraternity membership. In 1967, fraternity membership hit what was then a record low, with only 60% of the class of 1970 joining. The decline continued, and in 1970, only one-third of the class of 1973 pledged fraternities. The end of the old Colgate, a 150-year-old all-male college, was coming into view. By 1968 and 1969, in the most consequential change of all, women were finally breaching the walls of the previously all-male bastion. Full coeducation was on the way. At the end of his senior year in 1970, Howard Fineman looked back over his 4 years on campus. The protests against racism in the Vietnam War, the arrival of women, and the efflorescence of the arts. "The old Colgate chain of being," he proclaimed, "has collapsed."